What if I told you that the ultimate villain of the entire Stranger Things universe wasn't born, but he was actually manufactured by the United States Navy in 1943?
I mean, it sounds completely crazy, right?
It really does. But welcome to another deep dive. And if you're joining us today, you probably think you have a pretty solid grip on the timeline of Hawkins, Indiana.
Right, like the standard narrative.
Yeah, exactly. You think a young girl named Eleven accidentally opened a door in the 1980s and just let the monsters in? But today, we're going to completely rewire your understanding of this story.
Oh, absolutely, rewire it.
We are pulling from a single, very comprehensive source today, which is the official Wikipedia article for the hit stage play Stranger Things, The First Shadow.
And we really need to stress this right off the bat. This is not just some fun, supplementary spin-off.
Right.
The creators, the Duffer brothers, have been explicitly clear that this play is essential, official canon.
It's the bedrock of the franchise.
Exactly. It contains the definitive backstory of Henry Creel, who, of course, grows up to be Vecna. It explains the actual origins of Eleven's powers, and it gives us the exact connective tissue setting up the television series finale.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Because to understand the neon-soaked monsters terrorizing teenagers in the 1980s, we actually have to rewind the clock all the way back to the wartime paranoia of the 1940s.
Which is such a wild pivot for the series.
It is. And the real-world conception of this play is fascinating, too. While the Duffer brothers were writing season four, they realized they had this massive motivational hole.
Right, like why did this sinister Dr. Martin Brenner want to create psychic children in the first place?
Yeah, like why 11? You don't just wake up one day and decide to build a sensory deprivation tank for children without a huge systemic reason.
Right. And they realized they needed to anchor Brenner's actions in the Cold War era. The government was actually trying to create living weapons.
Which brings us to the opening scene of this play, which completely shatters the established timeline. I mean, we aren't even in Hawkins.
No, not at all.
We open in 1943, smack in the middle of World War II, on a United States naval ship called the USS Eldridge.
The government is conducting these highly classified experiments.
Right, they're trying to use a force field to turn the ship completely invisible to hide from German forces.
Yeah, but things go horribly wrong.
Yeah, instead of just cloaking the ship, the experiment accidentally teleports it into a dimension the play calls the Abyss.
And it is not empty.
No, there are strange humanoid creatures there, and they basically slaughter the entire crew. It's like that urban legend of the Philadelphia experiment, but crashing headfirst into H.P. Lovecraft.
That is a perfect way to describe it. And right there, in those very first moments, the lore fundamentally shifts.
Totally.
Because up until this play, the audience assumed the Upside Down was just this random, terrifying, alternate dimension that Eleven stumbled upon.
That, like, it was a total accident.
Exactly. But this prologue establishes that humanity actually forced its way in decades earlier. It wasn't an accident of psychic exploration, it was a direct consequence of military hubris.
They literally sailed a warship into a cosmic horror show.
Yes.
Wait, let me pause you right there, though, because I want to make sure we're getting the mechanics of this right. The play calls it the Abyss.
Correct.
Is that just a 1940s term for the upside down, or are we talking about a completely different dimension here? Because, I mean, if the Navy opened a door in the 40s, why does everyone in the 80s act like it's a brand new problem?
So that is a crucial distinction. The source material suggests the abyss is essentially the proto upside down.
Okay.
It's like a deeper, raw layer of that same cosmic space before it took on the mirrored appearance of 1980s Hawkins. Think of it like radioactive fallout.
Oh, wow.
The Navy didn't just open a door, take a look around, and neatly close it. They pierced a membrane. They sailed into this toxic environment, got slaughtered, and the metaphysical door they forced open left a residue.
Like they tracked radioactive mud back into our universe.
Precisely.
Okay, so if the military tracked this radioactive cosmic mud back into our world in 1943, how does that fallout eventually hit a random teenager in the 1950s? I mean, how do we get from a classified naval disaster to a high school in Hawkins, Indiana?
Well, the tragic consequences of that experiment kind of lie dormant for over a decade, but they eventually ripple outward. And that brings us to 1959.
Right, when the Creel family moves to Hawkins.
Exactly. And we meet a young, deeply disturbed Henry Creel. He has these psychokinetic abilities, he's tormented, and he's really struggling to fit in at Hawkins High School.
But he does find one lifeline, right?
Yeah.
He connects with Patty Newby.
Yes. the principal's daughter.
Right. And Patty really becomes the emotional core of this entire origin story. She absolutely refuses to see Henry as a monster.
She's so supportive of him.
Yeah, she convinces him that his powers aren't inherently evil, that he can actually control them. There's this incredibly tender moment where Henry uses his abilities to create a beautiful vision for Patty.
Oh, the singing scene.
Yeah. It allows her to sing and feel entirely supported by everyone around her. And it blossoms into this genuine, really sweet high school romance. I mean, they meet after school, they share a kiss.
It's very classic mid-century Americana.
It is, but, and here's where it gets really interesting, because we know exactly who Henry grows up to be, right?
Right, Vecna.
We know he becomes the ultimate villain. So based on what we're looking at in these sources, I have to ask, is Henry actually inherently evil at this point, or is he just a traumatized kid being hijacked by a cosmic parasite?
That is the big question.
Because the classic Beauty and the Beast trope usually implies the Beast has a choice in the matter, you know?
What's fascinating here is how heavily the source material leans into the tragic hijacking angle.
Really?
Yeah. The play does not portray Henry as some cartoon villain twirling his mustache. He is physically fighting for control of his own mind.
Wow.
When he's alone in his attic, he enters this mental space he explicitly calls the battlefield.
Oh, that's dark.
He is actively wrestling against a shadowy presence from that abyss that is trying to overtake him. Unfortunately, he's a teenager fighting a cosmic entity.
Yeah, he's completely outmatched.
Exactly. And he loses those battles. Under the influence of this shadow, he violently kills several local animals.
Including a cat named Prancer, which, as a quick aside for the fans listening, belonged to a young Claudia Yount, who grows up to be Dustin Henderson's mom.
The play is brilliantly seated with these familiar faces.
It really is. I mean, the high school is populated by teenagers you already know from the TV show. There's a young Joyce Maldonado, a young James Hopper Jr.
And Patty's adoptive brother, Bob Newby.
Yes, Bob. And they actually team up to investigate these animal killings, completely unaware that Henry is the one doing it.
It creates this profound, dramatic irony. You have this grounded mid-century teen detective story happening in the foreground, right?
Yeah.
While this inescapable cosmic tragedy is unfolding in the background, because Henry is terrified, he starts having visions of a humanoid monster. And his biggest fear is that this entity is going to eventually force him to hurt Patty.
And that fear almost becomes a reality. Patty convinces Henry to use his powers to try and locate her biological mother.
Right, a noble goal.
Yeah, but while he's searching inside the void, he loses control. The shadow entity takes over. Patty is terrified, and suddenly her father, Principal Newby, just walks in.
Terrible timing.
Awful.
Yeah.
And the possessed Henry violently attacks Mr. Newby.
But Patty's unwavering belief in Henry is what disrupts the attack. She screams that she loves him and believes he is good.
Wow.
And that gives Henry just enough agency to fight back the entity and stop.
But the damage is already done.
Sadly, yes. Mr. Newby is blinded and seriously injured. But the critical detail here is what happens when Mr. Newby wakes up in the hospital.
Okay, yeah, this is huge.
He tells Patty that Henry actually saved him from the monster. And then he asks for a piece of paper, and he draws a picture of the entity that attacked him.
He draws the mind flayer.
He draws the mind flayer.
I mean, just think about that. A high school principal in 1959 draws the ultimate boss monster of the Upside Down, and that drawing changes the trajectory of everything.
It really does.
Because the fallout from that attack is what forces Henry directly into the hands of Dr. Martin Brenner. I mean, Principal Newby is blinded, the town is completely on edge, and Henry's mother, Virginia, who, by the way, is being heavily drugged by Brenner, so she'll spill secrets about her son.
Which is incredibly sinister.
So sinister. She hands Henry over to the Hawkins National Laboratory. But wait, how does Brenner even fit into this at this point? Does he just magically know Henry has powers?
Not at all. And this is where the plot just explodes from a local town mystery into full-blown international espionage.
Oh, I love this part.
When Brenner gets Henry into the lab, the entire scientific conspiracy breaks wide open. Brenner reveals a massive secret to Henry. Brenner's own father was the captain of the USS Eldridge.
The ship from the 1943 prologue, the one that sailed into the abyss.
Exactly. Brenner's father was the sole survivor of that disaster. He returned to our world with terrible injuries, but more importantly, he returned with a completely unique, altered blood type.
Oh my gosh.
On his deathbed, he confessed everything to his son. And that confession is what drove Dr. Brenner to establish something called the Nevada Experiment, which was a desperate attempt to recreate the Eldridge anomaly.
Okay, I need to make sure I fully grasp the mechanics of this because it sounds completely wild.
It is wild.
The source material says one of Brenner's fellow scientists defects. He becomes a Soviet spy, steals this dimensional breaching technology, and hides it in a cave in Nevada.
Right.
And it just so happens that a very young Henry Creel, who's living in a town called Rachel, Nevada at the time, is out exploring one day.
Just a kid exploring.
Yeah. He stumbles upon the stolen Soviet tech, and he activates it with a spyglass. But wait, how does a simple childhood spyglass activate stolen Soviet sci-fi tech? Are we just glossing over that?
That is actually one of the most fascinating mysteries the source material leaves intentionally ambiguous.
Really?
Yeah, the play doesn't give us a technical manual for the device, whether the spyglass acted as an accidental mechanical key, or if Henry's proximity and, you know, latent connection to the dimension triggered it when you look through the lens. It remains a debated secret.
That's so interesting.
But what we do know for certain is the outcome. The moment he looked through it, Henry and the Soviet spy were instantly transported into the abyss.
Wow, and Henry is stuck there for 12 hours.
Yes.
That is where he is first exposed to the influence of the shadowy entity. When he finally returns home, his personality is completely altered, and most importantly, he now possesses the exact same unique blood type as Brenner's father.
Which changes everything.
So, wait, let me get this straight. Henry isn't a natural-born mutant. He didn't just happen to be born with psychic powers.
No.
He is essentially a contaminated byproduct of stolen Cold War technology.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the implications for your understanding of this entire franchise are just staggering.
Seriously.
If you take nothing else away from this deep dive, understand this. Stranger Things is no longer a story about a boy with magic powers. It is a story about a government-manufactured contagion.
A contagion.
Wow. The Upside Down's influence on humanity isn't portrayed as some mystical destiny. It is a blood-borne pathogen, and it was spread through a Cold War arms race.
That is insane.
It shifts the entire narrative from a standard monster fantasy into a deeply entrenched sci-fi government conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
Brenner isn't studying Henry because Henry is uniquely gifted.
Right.
Brenner is studying Henry because Henry is carrying the dimensional infection that Brenner's own father brought back from a botched military experiment.
That completely recontextualizes the entire show. And honestly, it makes the climax of this play so incredibly tragic.
It really does.
Because what happens to a human being when they realize they aren't a person, but just a biological petri dish to Dr. Brenner and a terrifying monster to their own mother?
They snap.
Yeah.
It is the absolute point of no return. Brenner tries to force Henry to use his powers to kill a prisoner in the lab to test him as a weapon.
It's awful.
But Henry refuses. His love for Patty keeps him tethered to his humanity. He physically breaks down, and he actually stabs two guards conventionally. But he completely refuses to use the psychic infection to execute someone.
Because he knows what it'll do to him.
Exactly. But Brenner immediately realizes that Patty is the anchor keeping Henry human, and he vows to find her and eliminate her.
So Henry escapes. He runs home, desperately hoping for a safe haven, you know. But using his powers, he reads his mother's mind, and what he finds is just the ultimate betrayal.
Heartbreaking.
Virginia isn't relieved he's safe. She's terrified, and she just wants to send him right back to Brenner's lab.
She gave up on him.
Yeah. And that betrayal is the final snap thread. Henry completely surrenders to the shadow entity's influence. While fully possessed, he murders his mother and his sister, Alice, before passing out.
Which is the crime we hear about in season 4.
Exactly. And because of the ongoing animal killings that young Joyce, Hopper, and Bob were investigating, because of all that setup, Henry's father, Victor, ends up taking the fall for all the crimes.
And when Henry wakes up from this possessed fugue state, he realizes Patty is still in imminent danger from Brenner.
Right.
So he rushes to Hawkins High School, which brings us to this massive, brutal showdown during the school's production of a play called Dark of the Moon.
Henry finds Patty hiding in the rafters above the stage. He desperately tries to give her good news. He tells her he actually used his powers to locate her birth mother in Las Vegas.
A glimmer of hope.
But then Brenner appears, and Brenner is just cruel. He calls Patty Henry's weakness. He tells Patty not to trust him.
Manipulating them both.
Yeah. And as Henry fights with everything he has to keep control of his own mind, the entity takes over one final time. Possessed by the shadow, Henry violently throws Patty from the rafters.
It's a devastating sequence. It visually and emotionally strips away the very last shred of humanity Henry was clinging to.
The absolute end of his innocence.
Brenner recaptures him, taking him back to the lab, while Patty is rushed to the hospital. The die is cast.
Which brings us to the epilogue. We jump forward a few years. An older Henry is back at Hawkins' lab, heavily restrained, but he's using the void to check on Patty.
He's still looking for her?
Yeah. He sees that she survived the fall. She has to walk with a cane now, but she's in Las Vegas, backstage at a casino, and she finally reunites with her birth mother. They recognize each other and embrace.
Which is lovely.
It's this tiny, bittersweet sliver of hope. Patty got the reunion Henry promised her.
But Henry's own fate is entirely sealed.
Right. So what does this all mean? The play ends with Brenner entering Henry's room. He tells Henry that the blood transfusions they've been administering to new test subjects, literally passing on Henry's infected blood, have been successful.
The contagion is spreading.
Exactly. He frees Henry from his restraints as a reward and takes him to the Rainbow Room. Brenner introduces Henry to a young child. Henry looks at the child and says, "Hello, Eleven, I have something new for us."
Chills.
Lightning flashes and the silhouette of the monster Vecna appears on the back wall.
It is a chilling, perfect puzzle piece. It slots this stage play seamlessly into the very first moments of the television series.
Seamlessly.
It completely wraps up the arc of a young boy who is discarded by his family, infected by stolen military tech, weaponized by his government, and ultimately consumed by the very dimension he was forced to carry.
It is a heavy, dense, reality-bending story. But, you know, that brings up a completely different, intensely practical challenge.
The staging.
Yeah. We've been talking about the void, psychic powers, cosmic shadow entities, and the mind flayer. How on earth do you put that on a physical theater stage in front of a live audience without it looking absolutely ridiculous?
Well, this raises an important question about the medium of theater itself.
Okay.
Translating sci-fi horror, especially horror that relies heavily on massive CGI and television, to a live stage is notoriously difficult. But the production team didn't just pull it off. They essentially rewrote the rulebook for stage illusions.
They really did, and the industry recognized it immediately. The West End production won the Laurence Olivier Award for Best Entertainment or Comedy Play, plus Best Set Design.
Extremely prestigious.
And when it moved to Broadway in 2025, it swept the Technical Tony Awards. Scenic design, lighting, sound, they even created a special Tony Award specifically to recognize the team behind the illusions and technical effects.
Well-deserved.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
And Louis McCartney, who played Henry, earned a Tony nomination for his leading role.
But what is truly fascinating about all this is the audience phenomenon. You are taking a massive global Netflix demographic and putting them into plush theater seats.
It's a culture clash.
It is. Co-director Justin Martin noted that the atmosphere was entirely unique. They ran surveys and discovered that around 60% of the audience had never been to a theater before.
That is wild. So you have a crowd that doesn't know or frankly care about traditional theater etiquette.
Exactly. They were eating popcorn throughout the show, vocally reacting to the scares, gasping, and responding to the actors in a completely natural, unfiltered way.
Mm-hmm.
They treated it like a live-action cinema event.
I love that so much. Theater shouldn't always have to be this silent, museum-like experience, you know?
It should be alive.
Right. And for the fans listening who couldn't make it to London or New York to eat popcorn and scream in person, Netflix actually filmed the first Shadow in February 2026 for a platform release.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, and they even included a massive Easter egg. Jamie Campbell Bauer, the actor who plays Vecna in the TV show, made a surprise cameo to reprise his role as the older Henry in the epilogue.
It's the perfect way to immortalize the production while directly linking the stage actors with the screen actors.
It really is. Well, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. Thank you for joining us to untangle this wild web of Cold War spies, bloodborne pathogens, and the tragic teenage romance that ultimately birthed the Upside Down.
We've been everywhere today.
We went from a military disaster on a 1940s naval ship down to a radioactive cave in Nevada, right up to the rafters of a high school auditorium.
And before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final thought to ponder.
Go for it.
Consider that statistic we just mentioned. 60% of this play's audience had never been to a theater before. They were openly eating popcorn, gasping, and vocalizing their reactions to the characters in real time, right in front of the actors.
Yeah, just immediate loud feedback.
Exactly. If a canonical, essential piece of a massive global story is shaped by the immediate loud feedback loop of a non-traditional live crowd, well, how might that intense live energy have fundamentally altered the DNA of the Stranger Things mythos?
Oh, that's a great point.
How different would Henry's origin story be if it had been written and contained purely in a quiet, isolated Hollywood writer's room, rather than breathing and adapting in front of thousands of screaming fans every night.
It makes you wonder who is really shaping the Upside Down at this point, the creators or the audience. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.